it is my honor to say, let's welcome back Mr. John Sebastian.
Great music town and pocket of the resistance.
Don't stop. Thank you.
sandwich, don't be nervous. We're going to get you the tunes you know we want to hear.
Take your time.
This, yeah, exactly. Let me just... And part of what you learned when you were hanging out with guys like Freddie Neal, some of the great players that were there, was the people that influenced them, their heroes. And, you know, I mean, after you'd heard that Midnight Cowboy tune or something, where you really said, oh man, this guy's, he's really got something. And then all of a sudden, he mentioned this guy, Floyd Tillman. It's good. This is why it's a music town. It's a music town. It's people who know. The most important guy for the spoonful in our education. And here's what I mean. We were probably working there for about a week, and Joe Mara is his name, sort of starts coming forward as the people are filing out. You have to imagine this club, it's like a shoebox, so there's only this first two rows, basically playing to people on either side. It's not cute. But as they're going, I can see Joe coming up from the darkness, and he goes, okay, guys, come here. Now, if you have Italian-American friends or an Italian background, you know that when a guy goes, come in, that's not good. And the other tell for Joe Mara was always when he'd go, he'd scratch his head and he'd go, here's the thing. And you always, you were going to get bad news. Okay, so he says, he gets forward and goes, okay, guys, here's the thing. You guys are no fucking good. Sorry, you know, you can't have that amp up all the way. These people here in the front, they're getting their heads cut off. Joe, you can't, you can't ride that cymbal. That's not a ride cymbal. That's a big crash cymbal, and it sound system can't deal with it, you know. John, you gotta stop looking at your feet. He says, I know you're trying to remember the words, but now and then. And Steve, you're good. Well, it was the most important piece of information I think we ever got, because it sent us scurrying to the basement of a hilarious hotel in Manhattan that we would go and rehearse in that basement, because there weren't really rehearsal halls for electric bands during that time. Well, we go, our next gig is at a place called the Cafe Bazaar. Now, the bazaar had all of the tables and chairs glued to the ceiling. You think I'm kidding? But it was a tourist trap, really, and nobody from the village went in there, which you might consider not to be an advantage, but we quickly discovered that playing for people from Dayton, I can make jokes about them, all my people from the white side of my family are from Dayton, so the Dayton folks would be on a program where you go bus to New York City and then you bus to Greenwich Village to see the Beatniks. That's the game. And so there'd be a guy who's called the Drag. He's outside. See the Beatniks playing music, and it was the silliest thing. But there was a wonderful part of this whole thing, which was that there was a jukebox at the Cafe Bazaar. I remember the first time that I heard Martha Vandellas playing Heat Wave. You know, that was also the first kind of, one of the first times that you hear the real Motown orchestra, and just how tight they were, just how really great. And I remember thinking, yeah, it's not just how good they're playing, it's those chords. Those chords are kind of, they're like, they keep climbing. It's really, I wonder if I could write a song that had a set of chords that climbed like that, you know? Of course, I'd have to change it a little bit. because maybe somebody might mistake it if I make it twice as fast. I'll make it twice as fast, then maybe they'll think it's twice as cool. See?
The
huge posters of disproportionately Well, we think, no, this is it. We're playing a club. We're playing music here. And, oh, here it is. Mothers. We get closer and we see a sign. Oh, boy, it's us. But as we get a little closer, we realize that the sign says, Topless Maria. But we're not going to be dissuaded now. Now we're here. We want to kill. Get out here on the stage. Got our stuff all tuned up. We start doing our set. And a thing we had not really anticipated was that Topless Maria was going to actually come out and shake it while we're trying to do a song. You know, and this is where I start to feel like an East Coast guy. I said, boy, you know, I just don't have any background for this. Starts dancing, and I don't know, I thought I was a badass rock and roller right up until she started dancing, and suddenly I don't know what came out, but like well, Topless Maria had a little conversation with us after the show. She said, you guys have never bumped a stripper, have you? And we all kind of, we didn't know whether that was an insult until she did explain that this was a reference to a musical response to when she bumps, you gotta have something to give her back, you know? Didn't take us long. Didn't take us long. By the next night, we're like, And we haven't really mentioned Zalianowski yet. He was my partner for all of the really exciting partners. Marvelous cat. Got arrested for a ounce of pot that ruined the band. It really sent us into a spin. But before that, we were just having so much fun because Yanofsky was like a party in himself. And all the strippers became his best friends. Now, these are the days when, you know, we were kind of rooming together, at least me and Zal were. And, you know, I'd have to come into the hotel room late and I'd have to come in like this. This could have gone on forever until I got that phone call from Kama Sutra Records. I know it sounds like comedy, but for you younger folks, there really was a label called Kama Sutra. Always who you want if you're going to go up against the Beatles, the Beach Boys, the Rolling Stones, on like Columbia, RCA, you know. But there we were. And this phone call came through. Artie. Hey, it's Artie. Hi, Artie, how are you? Hey, good. Hey, Artie, how's it going back there? How's the cash box doing? And Billboard. It's good. It's good, guys, but it's kind of leveled off. And I think you guys know what comes next.
the dive. Oh, no, we don't want the dive. We want to stay right where we are. And I had not one good idea to try to follow up, do you believe in magic? Because I knew it had to be a good tune. I might not have found it. We might have just been down there. Except for the fact that Steve Boone, our bass player, came into the room one night and he says, John, I got this fragment. I'll show you this thing. It's just a thing. It's not a song. Okay? So he plays me this thing. I go, Steven, that's not a thing. That's a song. We'll have this finished in 15 minutes. And it really was that kind of tune that just kind of wrote itself. And remarkably, we ended up back on the charts. So the moral is, if you're going to try to write a follow-up single 45, do try to enlist the services of a bass player. Because the bass player is going to give you that cool bass line.
Thank you.
12 tunes. Oh, God, that's all I can think of. Gotta come up with 12. And you know, there's only so much you can draw on, and especially at that phase of rock and roll. They're just, they're still just coming. And I remember a moment when I came back from summer camp. This goes back a few years before the Spoonful. I got drafted into a jug band. Is it true? I came back, I'd been a camper, a counselor all summer, and I came back, and as I walked in the door of Washington Square West, my mom was standing there with the phone going, "It's Stephen Grossman," because we talked a lot in those days. I'm pretty sure some of you guys have had experience with this guy's wonderful teach tapes and terrific guitar playing. I wish I was more in touch with him. I saw him a year or two ago, and we went right to the same point that we were at when we were 19, which is Stefan explaining something. And it was always like, okay, you know how we all go, we try to imitate Robert Johnson? And so we're all going, this is why I know no ancient history. We were focused all about this. Well, anyway, he drafted us. He said, come on down. We're playing at this little place in like a rehearsal hall on 14th Street. Okay. So I go down there, and I corner Stefan, and I say, Stefan, what's jug band music? And he says, look, just listen for a minute. You're going to see, this is not complicated. This is kind of blues with a little bit, some extra spices added in, you know? So we start to learn, we start to listen to these terrific records that were available at that point, specifically Harry Smith's composite album. An odd situation, it really was. This was a guy who was a Greenwich villager who would show up to all of these clubs that we played with handfuls of New York Times. Just not a good sign. So, I couldn't explain it. But this guy's interest in music was so wide that he would find these old 78s and put them on a 33 and a third album. And the thing that killed me was Gus Cannon. And by the way, I like anything that starts along. And you know, folks, this is the dark side of songwriting. This is the dirty, nasty side. And I remember listening to that tune and just thinking to myself, I think I have an idea for a great new song. She's one. that I'd be playing it long enough for it to become creepy.
You're my kind of creep, John.
Well, now I've been playing for folks my own age for 20 years or so, then folks and their parents for another 20, and now I'm on to, like, old people and their parents. But they also show up with grandchildren. And grandchildren, you just cannot anticipate what might occur to them. And in my case, it materialized in the form of a young man who sort of stayed near the front of the stage after the audience had really kind of drifted away. He waited for my attention and he said, "So, the guitars, you know, why do you need two of them?" And I realized that this is not an obvious thing for a lot of people, that instruments have so much personality. And one can be so different than another. I mean, I have a double handful of guitars, and sometimes people say, "Well, now, why is that?" I said, "Look, if you were going to do a play, okay, so you need your handsome leads, male and female, and you'd probably need, you'd need some character part guys. You know, you'd need the guy with a, you know, an eye patch and disorganized clothes or whatever." Well, this is what guitars do. Guitars, they're so different, and I still find it to be one of the coolest things that available to me on the planet. And
the strings of your heart.
Thank you.
admiring the Everly Brothers like I did, knew all of those B-sides, and knew that that was Chet Atkins playing on that. I was so amazed when about 1973 or so, my pal Paul Rothschild said, look, we, just Elektra Records, that is, we just acquired the Everly Brothers. Now, you have to understand that these guys have had several years where they really haven't been on good terms. And, but they indicate that they want to record, and I want to record them, and I just want to do the best job I can. So I think I'm going to stay out of the studio at first, and I'm all going, yeah, yeah, that's a good idea. Stay out of the studio, yeah. And she says, yeah, and so what I've decided is, if it's okay, I'd like to come and record at your house. The Everly Brothers at my house.
Yeah.
Wow. And it happened. It happened. And eventually, we got an album out of a song that I had written.
Gotta change guitars here.
Not too slick for you, is it? This was out in Los Angeles. I was living in Laurel Canyon at that point. Oh, Laurel Canyon. Yeah, it was starting to calm down a little by the time we got there. I must confess, yeah, I didn't, you know, have any of the real crazy times. Didn't sleep with Joni. I kind of was in another place.
You just kind of died.
Told him all the times he fell, singing all the stories he could tell. And all the stories he could tell. And I'll bet you it still rings like a bell. And I wish that we could sit back on a bed in some motel. Listen to the stories it could tell.
to the stories we can tell.
We had a couple of gigs, the Spoonful, that we were really trying for, and then it turned out to be really puzzling. We wanted to get into doing movie soundtracks because we thought we were so unorthodox that it would surprise somebody. Somebody might think it's good. So we connected with Woody Allen's management, who actually had connections to the Spoonful's management. And Woody was making a movie, and he wanted a kind of an unconventional soundtrack. Well, we thought this would be great because, you know, Woody Allen and the humor and everything. And then we realized that what he wanted was music for a Japanese spy flick that he had reimagined and redubbed so that now the whole mystery revolved around the discovery and the pursuit of a mysterious recipe for an egg salad. So good you could plot. And it's going to be called, let's see, what the hell was the original title?
What's that talking about?
It screwed us up because they changed the title right at the end. They said, okay, it's going to be called POW. You mean I got to write a song called POW? I've always been the guy with the finger in his nose when the passport picture gets taken. When the big dads took me out stealing chickens, it was me caught holding the bacon. When they're dropping a piano from the 47th floor, I'm the guy underneath hooking up. When the tidal wave strikes 100 miles at sea, I'm always in the rail throwing up. Well, why the fuck not? Now let's see here, you think I played this every night?
Original
characters, you know, not any existing cartoon characters and so on. And then I get this call from these guys, and they're just beside themselves. And they said, "John, we're hitting the big time." I said, "Really, really? What's happened?" They go, "Strawberry Shortcake." And this group of folks that had invented those characters had hired this company. So I'd like to take this opportunity to apologize to 1980s parents for all of that strawberry shortcake material that caused your daughters or sons to buy strawberry shortcake wallpaper and lunch boxes and stuff. Well, I thought that was pretty much the end of the run. And then I get another call from these guys. They're still pumped. What is it? They go, "Man, now this is the real big time." I said, "This is from direct from that group called Those Characters from Cleveland." And I go, "What's Those Characters from Cleveland?" And they go, "Care Bears." Oh, yeah. So I ended up writing for the Care Bears for a while. And in fact, I got a Canadian Emmy on a particular song. And it didn't receive not that much applause from the Canadian I know you're thinking that nobody cares. You got some feelings you don't want to share. But if your troubles stay all stuck inside, they're gonna grow till they're too big too high. So don't go sticking by your own sweet self. You gotta take a chance on someone else. That's what it's all about, just being friends. And take a chance on loving again. So tell me now, and let me show you where. When you think nobody cares. Nobody cares like a bear. Gonna have to, I don't know, find other work. And I get another call, and this is from Burbank. Of course, as you know, is Television Central out in Los Angeles. And I end up talking to a guy who I know immediately is from Brooklyn. And he explains to me that they're doing a television show, and it's based around this comedian stand-up routine, and come on in and let me show you some scripts and some short run-throughs of this thing. So I go down to Burbank, I see a couple of sort of attempts at this, but I can see, you know, this is sort of cool in a weird backwards way. So I go back to my house in the Laurel Canyon and start writing something, and it's terrible. But I'm kind of caught by the last phrase of the thing. And I ended up retaining that. So I go back the next day and I've got the song and I play it for the guys. I've actually made a little demo in my home studio. And they looked at me when I finished the song and they said, "You wrote this last night. Yeah. And you made the demo last night. Yeah. Okay, we want to know, how did you come up with it that fast? And I said, fellas, the truth of it is, I was a sweat hog.
About this beautiful woman that I met on Bleecker Street.
about 1962. She was one of those people that had all the right answers to the Italian vegetable and cheese and bread guys on that street. I noticed that they saved stuff for her. The man over in Zito's, they said they were out of whole wheat bread. And this gal walks in there and whispers to Mr. Zito, and all of a sudden, there's another loaf of whole wheat bread. And you know, I began to have a little weak spot for this Italian person. Miss Amato was her name. And she had boyfriends with cars and stuff, so I really felt like I don't have a chance. But I tell you, I might just invite her out in a kind of a casual way, like maybe show her some music that she hadn't ever heard or seen, or would be something special like that. I did work up my nerve, and I asked Miss D'Amato if she would come with me to the Bitter End Cafe. Because that night, there was going to be a man that I thought that she'd really be knocked out by. That was the Jim Question Chuck Taylor. Yeah, you gotta see these guys, man. This is something else. So there we went that night. We got down and sat down in that famous little club with that famous brick wall behind it that all the comedians and Peter, Paul, and Mary and everybody have their picture taken in front of that brick wall. And now here comes the band. Oh man, and they are cool. They're just real cool. Here comes Jim Queskin, this guy who can finger pick like John Hurt. I mean, it's really right. And then out comes Fritz Richmond, the super tall guy with bright red hair. Orange, bright orange shirt with huge collar and puffy sleeves. And little funny round antique glasses. And I'm saying, no to self. And now out comes their lead singer. This is this guy, Jeff Muldor. Yeah. We love this guy. And Muldor, who, yeah, you know, at that point, I'd never seen him, so I really didn't see it coming. Because, come on, the guy, he looks like a prep school instructor. You know, very, like, kind of greenish-gray clothes, nothing too, you know, spectacular. Huh? But then he starts to sing. And I'm going, damn, this is like Sleepy John Estes or something coming out of this guy. Whew, this guy is really cool. And I realize my date thinks he's really cool too. Well, I guess it all worked out because Maria D'Amato ended up marrying Jeff Muldor. And they had a real nice marriage. They moved to Woodstock, New York, and had a beautiful young daughter and a real nice divorce. And you know, nowadays, Maria, she leaves your neighborhood and gets on the plane and comes to Woodstock to spend a couple weeks and do a gig or two. And we all actually live there now, all of us. But you know, she calls me first.
Thank you.
For my baby, she know where I buy love and smoke for.
Thank you.
trying to pick up a line.
Early 60s, these disc jockey shows where there'd be
an incredible number of acts. I mean, 10 acts or something, usually one band. Each person did like 3 or 4 tunes was all. And Spoonful got on one of those and were the kind of, you know, the only actual kind of 4-piece band that didn't have a backup group or something. We'd do our thing. Well, I get in there and I sit down next to Mary Wilson, and we realize that Diana Ross is about to go on. Yeah, now Diana had recently done this movie on Billie Holiday. And so she was going to do that Billie Holiday thing. Now this is still the rehearsal day, but she comes out in the full getup. I mean, this black dress, jet, do we call that jet? It's a material that has black glass on it so that you shine any light on it and it just explodes. It's like a disco ball. So she comes out and she kills him. I'm going to interrupt this story to tell you another story. And this is when the Spoonful got this summer tour to play with the Supremes. Open up for the Supremes all summer. And that was what we did. And the thing about it was, it was all in the South. And the Spoonful had no insight into any of this. We really didn't know. Thank God for a particular trumpet player that just kept telling us what to do. And before we went on this particular show, this trumpet player said, "Now listen, we're going to finish this show. We're going to get back on the bus. We're not going to change into our street clothes. And we're not going to stay in this town. We're not going to eat in this town. So don't be like changing clothes and stuff after the show. Get back on the bus." Now this bus wasn't really strictly the Kenny Chesney model. It was actually a big orange school bus that we were traveling in. For at least, 2/3 of it. Then Diana began to have kind of separate situations. And so, well, there we were. So back to the 1999, and we watch Diana finish this song up, and the lights come up. Like I say, it's not the night of the show. They're readjusting this and that, and the cameras and the mics and the patting down Diana, makeup and all of this stuff. And there's this moment where Diana is starting to scan the audience in between, and she's looking this way and that, and then all of a sudden she points at my table and she looks at me and she says, "Didn't I sleep with you in a school bus in Alabama?" Something is new.
We have a few minutes to breathe.
Just these few hours, but I've been waiting since.